Well, what are you looking for in a home? What makes it a good location?
And we're asking because we really want to know for
as we put our houses
we'll talk
in front
later,
of you.
But we've got some pretty interesting houses.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you have to have the large.
Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in. This week, we'll talk with a former diplomat about his movie-worthy escape from Iran during the 1979 hostage crisis.
Then, a location scout tells us why your home could star in the next blockbuster movie.
And remember reading all those classics in high school? Well, we don't either. We'll learn why some books are worth picking up again.
Then, we'll talk with a woman who's had remarkable success in Africa challenging a brutal tradition.
Plus, shoot the breeze with the babes.
As a Foreign Service officer posted at the American Embassy in Iran, he was issuing a visa when militant demonstrators scaled the walls of the embassy. He and four other colleagues escaped out the back door onto the streets of Tehran. So began an 80-day odyssey where truth became so much stranger than fiction.
The group's experiences in Tehran became the basis for the movie Argo, which won the Academy Award for Best Picture.
What happened? Six of the hostages went out a back exit.
Where are they? The Canadian ambassador's house.
We got revolutionary guards going door to door. These people die. They die badly.
White House?
Who wants the six of them out?
We wanted to know what it was like to spend months in hiding, the eventual escape, and just how similar his experience was to that portrayed in the movie. We are delighted to have the real Robert Anders join us in our studios. Welcome, Robert, to Two Boomer Babes.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Can you describe for us that fateful day, November 4th, 1979, when you first realized it wasn't an ordinary day at the embassy? Were you terrified?
When we first realized it was not an ordinary day, it was when the embassy there was on a large 27-acre compound, 10 or 15 buildings throughout the compound. Fortunately, our building, the consulate, was up against the back wall. Now, we first realized it was not an ordinary day when folks from the Chancery building, it's the main building at the front of the embassy, called and said the usual daily demonstrators were climbing over the walls this time, so you better button up, lock up, and because they're going to be trying to get into your building shortly. And true enough, within a few minutes, we could see the demonstrators milling around inside the compound and trying to get into our building. So that's when we first realized it was going to be something different.
Now, how did you end up fleeing with those other diplomats? Did you all make a plan to flee together, or did it just kind of happen?
Well, maybe a little bit of both, actually. When we saw the demonstrators milling around the compound and trying to get into our building, as well as all the others, our plan was try to go to the British Embassy, which was about 8 or 10 blocks away. But also in the early minutes and hours, we all thought that the Iranian military and police would be coming to chase away the demonstrators and, you know, and secure the area, because a similar thing had happened back on Valentine's Day, and, you know, in February of that year. Demonstrators did take over the embassy for a few hours, but the military and the police came and cleared the area, and we, took over the embassy again. We thought, well, that's the same thing would happen. But, of course, it didn't happen right away, and we weren't sure what to do exactly, but we decided to, we had to get out of there, if possible, when after a couple hours we heard sort of footsteps on the roof of our building, or someone thought they smelled smoke. And we said, well, we've got to try and make a break for it. We could not go back out into the main area of the compound because it was full of demonstrators. We did have this back exit out into the back street. And so our one Marine guard took a look out the back door and saw that it looked fairly clear. So They said, okay, well, we'll make a break for it.
Wow.
In our building, we had maybe 60 or 70 people, about 30 visitors, Iranians there for visas, and some Americans there trying to take care of some of their problems. And we had about 20 Iranian staff employees and about 10 Americans.
So you all fled? Everyone
in
the building?
Well, yeah, sure. We sent the visitors out first, and then the 20 staff employees, and then the 10 Americans went out last.
Wow. How do you feel the movie portrayed your experience?
Well, it was based, the movie said it was based on a true story, and that's correct. It was based on a true story. But they took some artistic license in making a good movie. There were a number of things that that they changed. And my sort of analysis of the movie is that it was better than the real thing. It was more exciting. I mean, they exaggerated the dramatic parts, and they cut out a lot of the boring stuff. So
It'd make for a good film, you know.
Oh, it made an excellent film, yeah. I mean, none of us objected to that at all. I mean, because we realized it was, you know, it's not a documentary. They wanted to make a good story, which we all felt they did. I know the first time I saw it, and I think still do, I've seen it several times, I'm on the edge of my seat, you know, watching and see what's going to happen, because I knew how it was going to end, but still, you know, thought it was an excellent story.
We were the same way. We still are every time we see it.
Oh, it's a nail biter. Oh. You're listening to the Two Boomer Babes Radio Hour. Joining us in our studio is Robert Anders, a Foreign Service officer who was hiding in Iran during the 1979 hostage crisis and escaped with the help of the CIA. His story is portrayed in the Academy Award-winning movie Argo. Bob, you were talking about how you spent your days in hiding. Were you ever scared that the Iranian police were going to come knocking on the door, or the soldiers were going to come knocking on your door and take you into custody?
Our feelings on that varied somewhat. Actually, before we got with the Canadians, we were hiding in another residence of an American embassy officer. And that was actually the scariest part of the whole thing. We were in a neighborhood that we were not familiar with. They had a night watchman there who roamed around the neighborhood and would blow a whistle every 20 minutes or so. If it happened to be outside your bedroom window at 2 in the morning, it was a little interrupting.
Nerve-wracking, I'd say.
Nerve-wracking, right. Anyway, we managed to make contact with the Canadians because we were in touch with our chargé d'affaires, Bruce Langan, and two other embassy officers. They were in the foreign ministry. They were able to use a phone there the first few days, and so they helped us make this move. But then at one point they said they could not use that phone anymore. We were on our own. Good luck. So it was at that point I decided, recall that I had, luckily I remembered to bring with me my local phone and address book, and I called my very good friend John Sheardown at the Canadian Embassy, and basically he said, "Where are you? Why didn't you call sooner? Come on over here. You can stay with us." I said, "Well, I've got four other people with me." "That's okay. Bring them all," he said. So from that point on, we were with the Canadians. And then our day-to-day lives, from that point, were quite comfortable. We had four of us stayed with John Sheardown, and two of us stayed with Ambassador Taylor. The four of us with John Sheardown and his wife, we had a much better deal because it was a big, comfortable home. And the couple that was staying with the ambassador, the ambassador had a couple of local Iranian household staff employees. And no one was sure if we could, if we could trust them completely.
Right. And Bob, you tell me you never read so many books in your life.
That's true. I read 27 books. I know one of our group doubled that. He had read more than 50.
Tell us about the escape plan. Were you just blown away when you heard of this?
Well, and it was wild and crazy at the same time, and brilliant, let me say.
And brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that was our feeling, really. Because Tony Mendez, the CIA agent who was in charge of the plan, he explained to us that there were three possibilities. We were either a group of teachers looking for employment somewhere in that part of the world, in American schools, or a group of agricultural specialists looking at that situation in Iran, or this the film company. Well, that was the plan that the CIA had developed in great detail, and of course when they explained all the details, we thought that was, as you said, it was crazy but brilliant. I mean, none of us were, well, one of our group was an agricultural attaché, so he knew something about agriculture, but the rest of us didn't know anything about that, or none of us were teachers.
I just never realized the CIA was just so creative. My goodness.
Yeah. Shoe cameras, Kathy. Yeah. They invented them.
And you actually started to wear gold chains, right?
Unbuttoned
your shirt.
Yeah. Well, the way that happened was that Tony was explaining to us, you know, you're playing a role. You're somebody else, because we all had different names. We had Canadian passport, Canadian driver's license, credit cards, and we had, and they said, actually, one of the best parts of the plan that really sold us was that they actually set up an office in Hollywood. It was a Canadian film company. And we had business cards. And if I gave somebody my business card and they call that number, there was somebody there in Hollywood.
So they really answered. Alan Arkin, John Goodman.
Yeah.
Well, Bob, the scene at the airport was an absolute nail biter. And was it quite as scary as they portrayed it in the movie?
It wasn't anything like that, really. I mean, the plan was so perfect and it was organized in such detail. It went off, you know, very smoothly.
Really?
There were a couple little hiccups, but nothing like the movie, really. I mean, there wasn't any dramatic chase at the end, you know, that police and military cars chasing the airplane down the runway. That's nothing like that.
And then once you were on that Swiss Air flight, what did that feel like? And you were taking off.
Well, that was a moment of great relief when actually taking off. But
Perhaps landing or touching down on U.S. soil?
Well, but to go back to the movie again, at the point where they crossed the border from Iran into Turkey, in the movie they announced alcoholic beverages are now being served because we crossed the border or outside of Iran, that was really the moment that we realized that we were...
You were safe. They couldn't turn around.
And I bet
that
you popped the cork. You popped the cork.
Well, that's right. We did. That part of the movie was absolutely accurate because that's exactly the way it happened.
Well, Robert Anders, former Foreign Service officer in Iran, whose experience was portrayed in the Academy Award-winning movie Argo, thanks so much for sharing your most amazing story with the Two Boomer Babes.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Up next, ever wonder if your home could be the next location for a Hollywood blockbuster? Stay with us.
Support comes from Accent on Travel Rehoboth Beach with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Paul Kostick is a boomer with a really cool job. He's a location scout looking for that perfect locale for television, movies, or commercials. And unlike other strangers, when he comes a-knocking, people are usually thrilled. Paul joins us on the phone from New York City. Great to have you with us, Paul.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Describe what you do as a location scout.
I'm constantly just trying to find the right place.
And what movies and TV shows have you actually worked on?
I've worked on Sex and the City, the TV show. I did Howl with James Franco, Damages. One of my favorite jobs that I ever did was a little watched show called 100 Center Street with the great director, Sidney Lumet. That was an incredible experience.
Ooh, and I'm back to Sex and the City. So
yeah.
What locations did you scout for that one?
That was one of the easiest and hardest jobs I've ever done. It was hard because we were constantly changing the scripts at the last minute. But it was also one of the easiest shows that I've ever done in that everybody in New York wanted to be on that show. And so people would come out of the woodwork to try and get their restaurant or their shoe store or their coffee shop or anything, their apartment. Everybody wanted to be on that show.
Well, I can understand that. How about you, Barbara?
Oh, gosh, yes.
Now, how do you go about finding these locations?
I'm constantly looking. I'm always with my camera. I'm always taking notes on places. Of course, I'm also trying to remember what those places were 3, 4, 5 months down the road when we're looking for something sort of special. You can do cold calling, letters, talk to doormen of buildings. It's really just a wide gamut of things. I have an archive of every place I've ever been to, a digital archive, so that I can constantly refresh my memory that way.
You sound like you have to have great investigative skills.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, what are you looking for in a home? What makes it a good location?
And we're asking because we really want to know for as we put our
well,
houses
we'll talk
in front
later,
of you.
But we've got some pretty interesting houses.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you have to have a large amount of space because you think of any commercial that you're watching or any movie or TV show that you're watching, if they're using a real location, you have to have space for not only the action that's happening in front of the camera, but then you need space for the lights that go behind the camera. Behind the lights are the director and the camera itself. Then you have all of the support people and all of the equipment. So really space is a huge thing. You want it to be architecturally interesting, which doesn't necessarily translate to over the top, but it just means it has to have a certain element of a certain je ne sais quoi, as they say.
And it sounds like we'd have to declutter, Kathy.
Oh,
that would be
gosh.
Kind of difficult.
We'll just put away the pictures,
that's
right. All.
Well, what?
Well, you know what? If you don't want to declutter, we'll be happy to do that for you.
Oh.
Most of the time, we're going to change everything anyway.
Oh,
perfect.
I love that.
Yeah.
It's
can
cheaper
we
than
sign
moving.
Up? Okay.
Well, so what qualities in a home are usually deal breakers?
In New York, if it's a walk-up, that's gonna kill us after the second floor. Because if I show anything above a second floor, the grips are going to come after me. And they also don't like to be too far from the city here because we need to be able to get equipment back. We need to be able to do emergency runs into the city. So for the New York area, that's what's going to be a deal breaker. In other areas of the country, deal breakers are going to be size. It's going to be your driveway on an incredible hill that goes up, winding, that's hard to get to, sidewalks, entryways that are making it difficult for us to bring in all of this massive equipment. So there are any number of things that you're not necessarily thinking about when you sign up to be a location that could instantly kill it.
Well, our houses sound absolutely perfect. They fit the bill. Now, are people generally excited to have their homes in films?
You know, they are, because the people that want to do it are going to do it. And if they're not so excited to have their house in a movie or a commercial or a TV show, they're going to let me know by just saying, you know, I'm not interested. But the ones that are interested, they're really excited about it. It's a lot of fun.
And how much do these people get paid?
Depends on the project. It could go anywhere from, you know, $1,000 for their backyard for a half a day of filming to, you know, tens of thousands of dollars if they have a spectacular penthouse overlooking Central Park.
Wow.
It just really depends on what I'm looking for and what they have to offer.
Sounds pretty good. Well, let me ask you this, Paul. Do people ever have second thoughts if you're going to film like a grisly murder scene or like a horror film in their house?
Yeah, with lots of blood everywhere.
Or rape scenes.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of the things that never gets shut down. I'll knock on a door and I'll say, you know, I want to do this scene where we're going to break in through the window and he's going to chase you around, chase around the actor, and then kill her and throw her body in the backyard and bury her. And most people will say, that's great.
Bring it on. The more the merrier.
Well, of all the locations you've filmed, what's been your most memorable? What's your favorite?
Well,
well, besides Sex and the City, obviously,
yeah.
That was a hit.
You know, I did a movie a number of years ago with Robert De Niro in it. And I was at this location. What we did was we found an empty apartment building in Times Square, and we rigged it to blow up. And I was there for almost a month rigging the place, making sure it's perfect. And on the day that we were filming the scene where the huge explosion takes place, I was doing a final walkthrough with the fire marshal, and a speck of dust or something flew into my eye, scratched my cornea, transferred an infection to the other eye. I was completely blind, and they did the blow up, and I didn't even get to see it. And
yet, well, good thing your sight came back.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
Well, location scout Paul Kostick, Kathy and I have some great houses that we'd love for you to look at, and we don't mind murder and mayhem. Thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
You bet.
Up next, books to reread or read that you haven't touched since high school. Stay with us.
As a follow-on to our series, Beyond the Face of Alzheimer's, we'd like to let our listeners know about a new app developed by the University of Illinois at Chicago about dementia. The Dementia Guide mobile app has screening questions, resources, and management tips, which can provide invaluable information for caregivers and loved ones of persons with dementia.
The developers are looking for non-professionals to test the Dementia Guide mobile app and provide feedback. If interested in participating, please contact Dr. Valerie Gruss at 312-413-9000 or email vgruss, that's V-G-R-U-S-S, at uic.edu.
Hey, Barb, do you remember in high school reading Catcher in the Rye, The Great Gatsby, and Pride and Prejudice?
Yeah, but, you know, I think I mostly read the Cliff Notes.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. Well, here's our chance to reread some great books, or in some cases, read them for the first time, now that no one is grading us and just for enjoyment.
Now, that's a novel idea. In Practical Classics, 50 Reasons to Reread 50 Books You Haven't Touched Since High School, Kevin Smokler guides us through books commonly assigned in high school English class and tells us why they're worth picking up again now that we've matured, so to speak. He joins us on the phone from New York. Great to have you with us, Kevin.
Oh, great to be here. Thanks a lot.
Kevin, what's your number one pick?
Oh, shoot. Of the 50?
Yeah.
I always like to say with these things, you want to start short and easy because I assume everybody who is going to take on this project of rereading classics from high school is a busy person with family and community and job commitments. So I think my number one pick would probably be Emily Dickinson's poetry. They're short and they're meaty, and you can down two or three of them before lunch.
Hmm.
Oh, that's a
good
idea.
Never read that one.
Yeah.
Hey, what about The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, which was assigned in most high school English classes when Kathy and I went to school, but I'm sure it probably still is. You say that rereading it as an adult can really help us cope with aging. So why is that?
I picked up Huckleberry Finn again, and to my mind, what I remembered from high school is that Huckleberry Finn was like published on like the day the Civil War ended, and that it was all about talking about this era of slavery that had now passed. Turns out Huckleberry Finn was published 20 years after the Civil War had ended, and Mark Twain spent his 40s writing this book, so he was essentially just entering middle age when he decided to write Huckleberry Finn, and he also had his youth on his mind because he stopped and started Huckleberry Finn several times. And in the 8 years it took him to write that book, he wrote two memoirs about his 20s. God, if I was only that productive in the middle of a project where I could stop and write two additional books. But the time that Huck Finn is alive in is the time of Mark Twain's youth. It's the 1840s, and he's publishing this book in the 1880s, and he's saying, "Look at the look what has happened to the world." You know, the world of Tom Sawyer, the sequel to Huckleberry Finn, is whitewashed fences and crushes on neighborhood girls named Becky, and the world of Huckleberry Finn is human bondage and fathers that beat you when they get drunk. The world of Huckleberry Finn is scary and dark and unsentimental, and it seems Mark Twain seems to be saying that we've grown up, that I've grown up, that America as a nation has grown up, and we are perhaps better for being older and more mature because look at what we've left behind.
And we've survived.
Exactly. It is also the story of the survival of not only a young boy but of a nation, too.
Well, another one that made your list, and I actually read it in high school, was Fahrenheit 451, and I absolutely loved it. But there's a special message there for adults about not kind of getting stuck in a crappy old job, right?
You pick up Fahrenheit 451 and you realize there's no big brother in Fahrenheit 451. There's no fire chief. There's no boss. All of the crimes are committed by ordinary people doing jobs that eat away at their soul. And, of course, our lead character, Guy Montag, is a fireman who ultimately decides that the job he's inherited from his father and grandfather is destroying him from the inside. And so I love to hand that book to people who, the next time you see them over dinner saying, "Oh, God, I just got to leave that job. I know I've been saying this for the last 9 years. I want to hand them Fahrenheit 451 and say, look what happens if you stay too long.
And then there's To Kill a Mockingbird, of course, which, you know, I also read with maybe a glance or two at the Cliff Notes. But what would adults get out of rereading that book that they might not have when they were younger?
The thing that I totally missed reading To Kill a Mockingbird the first time around is that Scout Finch is telling us this story in flashback. The person who is talking to us as we read To Kill a Mockingbird is grown-up Scout Finch and not 8-year-old Scout Finch. And so she's looking back upon her own childhood and talking about the people who meant something to her. Harper Lee was 30 years old when she wrote that, was living in New York. She wrote it on the typewriter her father gave her when she was a young girl. And so I think there's a very strong part of that that is a thank you from a daughter to her father and saying, look at what I've accomplished.
Love that book. Well, Kevin Smokler, author of Practical Classics, 50 Reasons to Reread 50 Books You Haven't Touched Since High School. We babes have a lot of reading to do, Kathy. Thanks so much for sharing your list.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thanks for having me on the show.
Up next, meet an inspiring woman who saw a disturbing but deeply entrenched practice and refused to accept that it couldn't be stopped. We'll be right back. Hillary Clinton had this to say about our next guest. Molly Melching saw a deeply disturbing but deeply entrenched practice and refused to accept that it couldn't be stopped. Her relentless efforts are proof that commitment and partnership can drive transformational change.
Molly Melching has lived and worked in Senegal for almost 40 years. She is the founder of TOSTEN, an educational organization that has had remarkable success in empowering African women and challenging tradition. She has been named one of the 150 fearless women in the world by Newsweek magazine.
Her story is chronicled in However Long the Night by Amy Malloy. We are delighted to welcome Molly Melching to our studios. Welcome, Molly.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you with us.
Now, you are a boomer babe with a really interesting backstory. So
I am.
What brought you to Senegal originally?
I went to Senegal in 1974. As an exchange student, and I was supposed to be in Dakar at the University of Dakar for 6 months. And 38 years later, here I am, still
What's
living in Dakar.
What's another 38 years?
Yeah, right. I loved it, and I immediately started interacting with people in the community and saw certain needs. And because I loved it so much and felt so at home there, I didn't even really think about going back at that point after I was supposed to go back. And so I just became very involved, and particularly in children and working with children who weren't in school. I was working in the Medina, which is the most populated area of Dakar, and realized that all these children who were not going to school had really nothing to do all day. And also, I realized that they all spoke the national language, which is the majority speak Wolof. And I thought, wow, it would be great to have a children's center so that they could get books to read and learn to write and read their own language and to really give value to their songs and stories, and maybe even start teaching by using the Wolof language instead of doing it in French as it is done in the formal school. So I was in the Peace Corps, actually. I was in Dakar already for 2 years at the university. I got my master's at the University of Dakar, but also at the University of Illinois, where
my alma mater.
Barbara's alma mater.
High five.
Yes.
In Champaign-Urbana.
Yes.
Yes. Very proud of my my years at University
Fighting
of
Illini.
Illinois.
The good old Midwest.
Yes, because I'm from Danville, Illinois. And so that was close by. And that was their first year for an exchange program to Africa, strangely enough. So I did get my master's from University of Illinois, but also from University of Dakar. And while I was there, and then got in the Peace Corps. Afterwards, I got funding to continue the activities in the center through the Spencer Foundation in Chicago, and then kept on with the center. But around 1982, started going around with a radio program in national languages. And that took us to our little team, to going out and actually visiting villages, and we decided to actually move our center to a village. And that's where I began an educational program.
Well, Molly, let's talk about your organization, Tostan. What does it mean, first of all?
Tostan is a Wolof word, and it's literally the hatching of an egg. It's the spread. It's the spreading, and for us, of course, the spreading of knowledge. And that word is so important in our organization because we give a basic education to girls who have never been to school and even who may be married at 13 and 14 years old, because there is a lot of child marriage in the countries where we work, and need this basic information in their own language to be able to make important decisions about their future. They need to know about their bodies. They need to know how you get pregnant. What is menstruation? So that they can explain it to their own daughters. Many of them didn't know what menopause was.
Well, at 12 and 13, they're babies, really.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
To tell you the truth, there were a lot of things I didn't know either, and I thought, boy, we could all learn about these basic health facts that can save lives.
Well, speaking of health, a major focus of your organization is ending the practice of what is called female genital cutting. So can you explain what that is?
I can. It is a traditional practice that has lasted over 2,000 years in Africa. It's practiced in 28 countries and usually is practiced on young women. It can happen from all the way from when a girl is a baby to when she is 12 years old. And it consists of cutting the genitals, especially the clitoris, and then sometimes there are other more severe types where the lips are cut and they can even be sealed or sewn together in different countries. The type depends on the ethnic group that is practicing. And I know it sounds absolutely horrible. And when you describe it, you just are so shocked. And it is hard to imagine that a mother would do this to her baby girl or to her young daughter. But I think you have to realize, and I tried to explain to Americans that it is a practice that was handed down to these women, not as an option, but rather as an obligation. It became almost like you have to do this if you want to have a daughter who is respected, who's accepted, who is not considered as dirty. Somehow they associated this practice with being a respectable woman, of having the status you deserve in the community. And if you haven't gone through it, you have no place in society. So you can imagine people coming in from the outside telling them, oh, you know, this is horrible. Stop. Oh, this is, how could you do this? This is barbaric. And even telling the women, you know, you're mutilating. Mutilating means to cut with the intention of harming. Now, these women didn't intend to harm their daughters. They're doing it because, really, this is what you do. So it's until you know and you're educated, again, you have to realize that almost all of the people that we work with in thousands of villages in Senegal and in seven other countries have never been to school. So they are even believed that if you had problems during this practice, it was due not to medical reasons, because they didn't understand germ transmission and getting infections resulting from germ transmission. they didn't understand that medical reasons. They attributed this to some kind of mysterious forces, that evil spirits perhaps that didn't like them or were angry with them, or they had shown some kind of displeasure to the ancestors. And when you don't know and you don't have information, you seek an answer. Why? Why did my daughter have problems? Why did she die? Why? And when you don't have those answers, it's very difficult. And those answers are passed down and somehow believed.
You are listening to the Two Boomer Babes Radio Hour. We're talking with Molly Melching, founder of Tostan, which has had great success in ending the practice of female genital cutting in Africa.
How does an organization like yours even begin to change a social norm that's been around, like, as you said, for 2,000 years? How do you even begin?
You know, it's very interesting that our organization never had on their agenda to end FGC, to get the women to end FGC or the communities. I never even dreamed that was a possibility. I wouldn't have dared to say, you know, I as an American and a white American also could come in and change a culture. I did not have that on my agenda. My agenda was simply women need education. Women are not getting it. They need to have these facts. They need to know what happens to them, how bodies develop. And they need to know about hygiene. And they need to know, and this was critical, is when we introduced human rights. They need to know they have the right to health, but they have responsibilities also. And that they have the right to be free from all forms of violence. They need to know they have the right to speak out and voice opinion about different things that affect their lives. And when they started learning this, they were the ones who said to me, we've decided to end this practice. And I was really stunned. I never expected this. And I couldn't even believe it. The coordinator in the project told me, one of our villages has practiced female genital cutting for centuries. And they have decided to end this and not have their public ceremonies as they do every year. This was in 1997. And I said, I don't believe it. I can't believe it. What?
You empowered them.
I think it was empowerment process that led them, yes, to being able to do that.
Molly, do governments in the various locations support your organization, support Tostan?
Oh, absolutely. They really do. In fact, their national action plans are very much based on the model that Tostan has piloted over the years and has proven really effective and successful. They have done evaluations of our program, and they also like the other impacts. Our program is comprehensive. It's not just, you know, set out to end FGC. It's really about giving economic possibilities to women. We teach project management, how to do a feasibility study, how to start your own microfinance and microcredit initiatives. And we see that the women are now making money. They have projects. They're working. The men are in agreement because they see the health of their families improving. They are doing so many things. They're building latrines in their homes. They're vaccinating their children. Everyone has a mosquito net now. And so in terms of governance, participation of women and decision making in the community, all that has changed. And I think that it's that kind of approach where people see it's not just, oh, here come those Westerners telling us to
right,
we need
right.
to do
it's
family
grassroots.
Planning. Exactly.
Right. It's grassroots.
Well, and it's comprehensive. It's holistic.
Yeah.
It's like, let's. We always say, and this I think this is really important, we ask people, what do you want for the future? What is your vision of your community 5 years from now? And they're the ones who say, we want to be in health, well-being, peace, you know, and we want to maintain our positive traditions. And so we always refer to that.
Real quickly, Molly, do you see this practice ending in our lifetime?
I see this practice ending in our lifetime. I'm very optimistic. We've even said that by 2015, we really believe the majority of villages in Senegal will have abandoned. And we're, you know, with this book that has come out now, however long the night, we're hoping to show people who thought that this was impossible, that there is now a way forward.
Wow, I wish we had more time. Molly Melching, founder of Tostan in Senegal, thanks so much for bringing this very important issue to our attention.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Up next, Shoot the Breeze about Carl Reiner.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Support comes from Accent on Travel Rehoboth Beach with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
As a follow-on to our series, Beyond the Face of Alzheimer's, we'd like to let our listeners know about a new app developed by the University of Illinois at Chicago about dementia. The Dementia Guide mobile app has screening questions, resources, and management tips, which can provide invaluable information for caregivers and loved ones of persons with dementia.
The developers are looking for non-professionals to test the Dementia Guide mobile app and provide feedback. If interested in participating, please contact Dr. Valerie Gruss at 312-413-9000 or email vgruss, that's V-G-R-U-S-S, at uic.edu.
This is the news. This morning, we are saluting the 2.2 million women who have joined in the war effort. They now make up 37% of the workforce, changing their role forever.
The prestigious Harvard Medical School is breaking ground today, opening its doors to new female applicants.
Today, little girls all over the world look to the sky, where the first woman is now in space.
Military stereotypes are challenged today with the trailblazing promotion of a U.S. female officer to four-star general. It was just announced that the vast majority of last year's doctorate degrees were earned by women.
We've come so far, but our news is changing for the worse. More women die from heart disease and stroke than men, even though it can be prevented. Make a change at GoRedForWomen.org today. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the American Heart Association's Go Red for Women.
Who might you save?
Your mother, your father, your husband, uncle, and son.
Learn FAST, F-A-S-T, the sudden signs of a stroke, and you could save
your friend, your best friend, teacher, boss, coach.
F, face drooping, A, arm weakness, S, speech difficulty, T, time to call 911. F-A-S-T, face, arm, speech, time. That's F, face drooping, A, arm weakness, S, speech difficulty, T, time to call 911. The sooner they get to the hospital, the sooner they'll get treatment. And that can make a remarkable difference in the recovery of
your neighbor, the waiter, a fellow shopper, a total stranger, grandmother, grandfather.
So learn FAST, the sudden signs of a stroke, then pass it on, because you never know who might save you.
Your wife, your colleague, teammate, mother.
Spot a stroke fast. Visit strokeassociation.org. Brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
Barbara, we've got to be the luckiest babes in the world. I'm having the chance to talk with so many amazing people from all walks of life every single day.
Absolutely. So what convo stands out in your mind these days, Kathy?
I'm thinking Carl Reiner, you know, the king of comedy. What a down-to-earth man. He is so amazing, and at 92 years young.
Oh, I loved our conversation with him. And you know what really struck me? The guy, as you said, at 92, he's as sharp as a tack. His timing is absolutely perfect, and he comes across as such a regular schmo, a guy.
He does. And don't you love all the accents he does?
Love
he carries
it.
Out, you know, every little, you know, line he has to say is a different, you know, genre of whatever.
Oh, and the Yiddish accents.
Oh,
and then
yes.
He talks about, like, his kids' birthday parties, bringing the Chinese food and his daughter's nose job. The guy could be one of my relatives very easily. Very easily.
And by the way, our friend Aileen Ellis, host of Primetime Focus, has some really great picks for great reads that actually include Carl's new book and some of his cronies. So let's take a listen.
Here's a quadruple whammy, four really funny books. I'm still crying with laughter over them. I'm Aileen Ellis. This is Primetime Focus. I'm reading about Carl Reiner, Dick Van Dyke, Sid Caesar, and Mel Brooks. I love the world they lived in. Fascinating friends, wild ideas, and lots of chutzpah. My favorite book is My Anecdotal Life by Carl Reiner. It really gives you a glimpse into how comedians think on their feet and create ideas that fly like sparks from a fire. So, Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks, for example, came up with the character the 2,000-year-old man, a guy who's met everyone from Joseph Stalin's plumber to Jesus, whom Mel Brooks in character describes this way. Thin lad, wore sandals, walked around with 12 other guys who always wanted water, so I gave it to them. Thank you, Carl, Dick, Sid, and Mel, for teaching me how serious events and humor can intertwine. I'll list the four books on our website. That's Primetime Focus, brought to you by AARP. I'm Aileen Ellis. Hear all our programs on the web at aarp.org/radio.
Well, I absolutely loved Carl's book, his other one, I Remember Me. I mean, what a great title is that?
I loved it.
Terrific. And you know what I really enjoyed about him is when we were chatting, the first person he talked about was his beautiful wife, Estelle. You could hear the love and the passion in that man's heart. And unfortunately, she passed away a couple of years ago.
And she had that fabulous line in the movie When Harry Met Sally, when she's sitting in the deli eating a sandwich and Meg Ryan is faking the big O. And what does she say, Kathy?
What did she say? She's, I'll have what she's having.
And you know what? I can't eat a corned beef sandwich in a deli without thinking of that line. That is the best line of all.
He is so funny. And what about when he talked about being the first Ashton Kutcher, long before Ashton Kutcher was even born?
Well, and it's really kind of true because apparently Estelle was about 8 or 9 years older, but unlike Ashton Kutcher and Demi Moore, his marriage lasted more than 60 years, which is a huge accomplishment.
Can you imagine that in Hollywood these days? And you know, the other thing I really loved was his relationship with Mel Brooks. Do you remember when he said, they get together every single night. I would love to be a fly on the wall.
And they've been best friends for over 60 years, too. And can you imagine their conversations? They may just crack each other up constantly.
And I bet there's a little liquor involved. What do you think?
I would think a bit. I would definitely think that would.
Just think, maybe that'll be us someday, Barbara, you know, in our rocking chairs. Or maybe we'll be lounging in Costa Rica.
Maybe with a few martinis or a few Manhattans.
Oh, absolutely.
And for any of our listeners who missed our full-length conversation with Carl Reiner, visit twoboomerbabes.com.
And be sure to join our conversation. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Two Boomer Babes.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Summer is in full swing, which means travel season is upon us. And there's nothing like an adventure to a new city or new country to get outside of our comfort zone and really shake things up.
For those looking to save money and enjoy a more authentic travel experience, there are some new travel sites that make touring a new city a little friendlier. Sarah Knipe, a social media strategist and communications consultant, joins us to talk about some of these new travel sites. Welcome, Sarah.
Hi, Kathy and Barb.
So, Sarah, let's talk about a few of the more out-of-the-box sites for these travelers. First is EasyNest. What is that?
So EasyNest is a site for solo travelers who are looking to save money while traveling. Basically, travelers use the site to share their rooms with other travelers so they can have access to better hotels, better locations, and make new friends.
Okay. But are the potential roommates vetted in any way, or does some stranger just show up in your hotel room saying, here I am?
That could be a little scary.
I want the left side of the bed.
So you do have to create a profile. How it works is you sign up and you create a profile, and they do encourage you to input your social networks like Facebook and Twitter and write a description about yourself. And the more information you complete, the more likely hosts are to accept you to share, you know, your reservation with them. So they do have that as a safety net. But there's not a whole lot more that screens. So you have to use your own judgment with that.
Sarah, is there any recourse if the potential roommate sort of backs out and refuses to pay their half of the room after you spend this wonderful night with them?
That's a great question. And honestly, there is not anything legally binding with this. Basically, the host is ultimately responsible for the cost of the room, and they enter the contract with that potential roommate in good faith.
Ooh, the good faith part.
I think this sounds a little shaky. I'm going to stay away from that one. Okay, now there's another really cool site called tint.travel that'll help travelers find someone to host them in a foreign city or show them around or even share dinner. So how does that work?
It's an application that helps travelers and locals meet all around the world. And you sign up via your Facebook account and you fill out a travel profile of what you're looking. And you can also have the option to be a host. And then you'd select what you'd like to offer guests, or if you're a guest, what you're looking for. So sightseeing, eating, a place for a drink, or a place to sleep. And it's a great option for someone, a traveler who wants to sort of step off the tourist track and go into the local culture, or a local person who wants to travel while staying at home.
Hmm. Does it take some of the worry out of your host maybe being Jack the Ripper? I mean, how do you kind of screen that?
So once again, this is based around Facebook. So the host or traveler is able to view the information on that person via their Facebook profile.
So you would know a friend of a friend of a friend. Somehow you'd be linked, you're saying?
Exactly, yes.
Okay, but then let me ask you this. Would all those people know where you are and that you're traveling then?
That's more on the traveler, I think, to let other people know where they're going. But yes, you communicate through the website.
Okay. Well, you know, we thought this next one was absolutely ingenious. Voulez-vous Diner, I hope I'm not just butchering that, which originated in Paris. So how does that site work?
This is such a neat website. So Voulez-vous Diner is a site where people can unleash their cooking talents and turn their private dinners into a unique culinary and cultural experience basically anywhere in the world. So let's say, Kathy or Barb, that you wanted to make dinner and wow everyone with your amazing cooking skills. What you guys would do, you'd set up a dinner as a host on the site, and then you'd set the price of the dinner, post it, and other people could register to attend your delicious meal.
Wow. But is there a way to check out the host and maybe their cooking skills, you know, before making the reservations?
Yes. Guests who are looking for a personal dining experience can peruse the website by location, and then they can see the ratings given to the host, and the evaluations are provided by the guests, and they rate on ambiance, food, and place.
Okay, but what if it's the first time up and there's no ratings?
Then you eat at your own risk.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Hmm. Yes.
I'd want to personally know about my guests that were coming to my house right. for dinner.
Or make sure your insurance is up to date in case you get food poisoning, maybe.
Oh, my gosh, exactly.
Your Medivac insurance.
Be sure to have that balloon policy or whatever it is.
Sarah, does it cost to use any of these sites?
There's not a cost to use the site. There is a cost. There's a 3% fee charged for each confirmed dinner. And then they also have a reservation fee that is, I guess, totaled by the host, and that's 20 can be up to 20%. So it's not an exact fee, but the host sets the amount of the dinner, and that's basically the fee you're paying.
Well, Sarah Shepherd Knight, social media guru, it's always fun to talk with you. Thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
Thank you both.
And now it's time for us babes to give credit where credit is due.
Audio and technical guru Julio Gonzalez, who magically pulls it all together.
Webmaster wizard Gail Jane, who makes TwoBoomerBabes.com a fab place to visit.
Founding members of the Chicago chapter of the Two Boomer Babes Supper Club, Mike and Larry Israel, for your unfailing love and support.
Our husbands, daughters, family, and friends, even with smirks and eye rolls, who encourage us all the way.
And give us great material, often without knowing it.
Our moms and upstairs directors, Jane and Sally, who are cheering us on from their bridge game in the sky.
Our home away from home, Delmarva Public Radio. And to you, our listeners, for joining us each week and spurring us on.
Two Boomer Babes is a production of Two Boomer Babes Media in collaboration with Zimer Communications.